Malcolm, can I ask you to introduce yourself, to give us your full name and your date of birth and where you were born?
Yeah, Malcolm Kevin Lucas. I was born on the 19th of February 1943, and I was born here in Gawler at the Hutchinson Hospital, and then moved out to Kangaroo Flat when I left the hospital, yeah.
Okay. So you were born here during the war years?
That's correct, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Can you talk to us a little bit about your mother and father and what you know about their lives prior to your birth?
Well, my father was a farmer, and he was born on the farm at Kangaroo Flat in 1905. My mother, she was the daughter of a market gardener, and I think it was 1908 she was born. And in her youthful years, they lived at Virginia on a market garden there. And then when she became old enough, she went and worked as a nanny housekeeper for some of the upper class in Adelaide. And I know that she worked for the Kay family. She often talked about during the summer they would go from their house in Adelaide and live in their holiday house at Robe. Then she worked for, I think it was her cousin, Dr. Willie Upton. He was a skin specialist, and he lived in Ferguson Square in Toorak Gardens. So, and she lived there with him. So that was my mother and father. And
how did they come to meet? Do you have any knowledge of that?
My mother was a Modra, my father a Lucas. And the Modras and the Lucases migrated from the same village in Germany. And they lived here in the Gawler area together, and I believe that they met at a party, a Modra family party. Yeah, that was their first meeting. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so your father was a farmer at Kangaroo Flat.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. He worked on the farm at Kangaroo Flat. He was the youngest son of the family of William Lucas. And it was tradition in those days that the older boys got help to establish themselves as farmers, and the youngest one remained home, worked on the old family farm, and then when the father died, it would pass on to him. And that was what Dad was doing. He lived there all his life on that piece of land. Yeah.
So your parents would have lived through the Depression era. I wonder if you can talk about their experiences they had prior to and during the Depression.
Right. They married in 1933, and the Depression was probably at its worst at that stage. The Lucas family had committed themselves to buying land in 1929, and obviously they paid too much for it because the crash that came reduced the price of land hugely. Dad always used to say they paid £21 an acre for it, and the Depression came, and wheat dropped from 4 11 pence halfpenny a bushel to 9 pence, and that put the family in a parlous position. They had to sell some land in order to remain on the land, and the other aspect was that when they bought that land in 1929, the vendor financed it, and it was a handshake loan. He died, and then the trustees wanted to recall the loan, and grandfather couldn't find the money. Anyway, through the goodwill of the wife, she specifically specified that she wanted the loan to continue under her husband's terms, and that was what saved the farm. But it left them in a parlous position, and
they would have been in a desperate situation.
It was shocking. They got married, and they had these plans. They bought some furniture, and the only thing they could do was live in this room, and the room was probably about 14 feet by 12 feet or something, and that was their entire home. And they used to use the kitchen of the farmhouse, but there was no running water, bathroom, toilet, anything of any consequence. There was no conveniences at all, no electricity. And they lived in that room for 19 years until grandfather died, which was in 1951. When grandfather died, then the farm was horribly run down because they'd sort of, you know, left all the maintenance and everything on hold in order to try and repay the loan. It was only just before he died that they were able to repay the loan and sort of get onto an even keel. And in the process, some of the land was given to one of Dad's brothers, and the other brothers were given some financial help and other assistance in order to establish themselves. So there wasn't any money or anything. And anyway, but the good times came after a few years. Dad was able to make enough money to buy some more modern machinery and then to build a new house, which he did a lot of work himself. And so they sort of got themselves to a point, but they never really got over that. It marked them mentally for the rest of their lives. So they, even though, like, at the end of their lives, we was doing quite well, it was, you know, today could be the last day that you'd get a decent return on anything because it could crash tomorrow. That was the basis of their lives.
And I guess, like many people who may have faced similar circumstances or lived through the Depression, that they became very, very frugal, sort of people, didn't they? There was no waste.
Yeah, well, Mum and Dad, if they went shopping to Gawler, they'd always take a bottle of water with so they didn't have to buy a cold drink, you know, and so on. That was the standard thing. And like all the cooking and that, they used as much as the farm produce as they could possibly use. Mum used to dress the chooks, and when the chooks wasn't laying, they'd run their course through their laying life. She would dress them and cook them up for soup, and we'd eat them. And and Dad would kill a lamb or something, and we had butter and eggs and so forth. Mum used to milk. At times they had a dozen cows they used to milk and sell the cream. The skim milk would be fed to the pigs.
Can you describe the farm? What was what did they do on the farm?
The farm that Dad inherited was 296 acres. It was a mixed farm. It had everything you could think of. They used to crop. And up until about 1950, they had horses. So they used to have to grow hay for the horses to feed the horses. And the hay would also, they'd cut it into chaff, and then the cows would be fed that also. And they didn't run any sheep of any consequence until grandfather died. But yeah, there was cows, cropping, fowls. Mum used to buy the chickens as day olds, and then she'd set up a box and put a hurricane lantern or some other, you know, fossil fuel thing that would burn and create some heat in there. And she'd raise the chickens, and she used to do an excellent job. She'd get down there on her hands and knees, and each day she would put bags on the floor, and they would be taken out, and all the manure on them would be cleaned off and until they got big enough that they could run outside. And then they had little humpies, I suppose, or chicken houses, we used to call them. And they'd put the chooks in there, and sometimes after a while the chooks would get sick of sitting in there, and they'd let them out during the day. And instead of going back in their house, they'd go and sit up in the tree, perch in the tree. And then, of course, they'd lay their eggs in the bushes and and so forth. And they had to be aware of where a hen was cackling in order to
work out where
the eggs were. And I remember one night we had a big wind, and it was so fierce it blew all the chooks out of the tree, and they were wandering around on the ground because they couldn't get back up in the tree in the dark. But so that was it. Mum was a very keen sower. She used to make beautiful clothes, and you don't see anything like it today. The quality of the material and the design and the clothes and the ornateness of the design, and that it was just beautiful. When she died, she had wardrobes full of unused material. She'd buy it when she'd see a beautiful piece of material, and then she'd put it away. I'll make that up one day. The other thing that probably is relevant too is that Dad's sister, Auntie Ivy, never married. And I understand that this was a part of the German thing, that the youngest daughter remained home to look after the parents as they got old. And she did that. And when Grandfather died, he left it in his will that Dad had to look after her as long as she lived, and he did. So, yeah, and she was beautiful. She was a lovely lady. Yeah.
That's a remarkable story.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming here that their farm was typical of all the farms in the community, that they were mostly mixed farms?
Yes. Yeah, similar size. There was really nothing... you were fairly limited in the amount of land that you could manage. There were some farms of 1,000 acres or more, but they had multiple, like horses. I think Dad said you could sort of cultivate about 20 acres a day, and they used to have to cultivate the ground frequently because the sow sobs had got in, and the only way that you could get any advantage over the sow sob was to continually cut them off, and hopefully they'd exhaust their bowl and they wouldn't be very proliferous. So you used to have to cultivate the ground multiple times, and the amount of work, like when I left school, you would cultivate the land, and then when you finished, you would start again because the sow sobs would be coming through again, and that was the way they did it. Yeah. Also, the varieties in those days were like the wheats were quite long in the straw, and a lot of that was so that it had a multiple use for either grain production or hay production.
Yeah.
The barley that we grew was very fragile. It was prone to the head breaking off before you could harvest it. If you got a reasonable wind on it, it would break the head off. It was a very good barley as far as beer making. I remember the year that Grandfather died, Dad had a magnificent crop of barley, and before he could start to reap it, we got this big north wind. And he reckons it was going to go, you know, 15 or 18 bags, which was unheard of in those days. And it finished up, went 2 bags because of the wind,
And bags per acre?
Bags per acre, yes. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it was disastrous, you know, but they sort of accepted that as a part of life. You know, today it's not sustainable that you could accept those sort of losses, but that's what happened in those days.
Back a few minutes ago, you mentioned this word, I think, German tradition. I have to say that the name Lucas doesn't sound particularly German. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. Yeah.
Well, it is German. There was a folk story that because of the two wars and so forth and the people's dislike of the Germans in the wars, that the Lucases, because Lucas is also an English name, and the story was that in the Middle Ages, the Lucases picked the wrong king, and they went over to Germany. But I don't believe that to be true. I think that if you go to Germany now and the area like Silesia or Prussia, wherever they call it over there, there's plenty of Lucases there. And I've been there and I've met some of the Lucases over there, and they're spelt the same way as ours. And I believe that the Lucases also, they tended to migrate around Europe. They were Wends or Sorbs, and that was an ethnic minority in that area. And they were the sort of the working class, and they were generally looked down on by the higher Germans. what I can read is that they did migrate around, and at one stage they were over as far as the Ukraine, and then they migrated back into Germany there. But the other interesting thing is that my mother was a Modra. They came from the same village in Germany as what my parents did, my father did, and they came out in 1854, and my father's family came out in 1858.
So they all came out fairly early in the life yes, of the colony.
Yeah, that's right. There was a lot of problems in that area. The land was generally not very fertile, and generally they were sort of leaseholders. They didn't own the land because they were the sort of the working class, and they were looked down. Apparently, there was a lot of bad years prior to them leaving, and also back earlier, Napoleon dragged his armies through that area as well, and burnt the villages, you know, raped the women, etc. And the other thing, of course, was the religious persecution that and it really was persecution, because the German government decided that they were going to have a state-sponsored religion, and the Lutheran religion was going to be abolished, and it was quite serious stuff. They were closing the churches down and going into the churches at gunpoint and, you know, arresting the people and so forth. So there was a whole series of factors that caused them to migrate. Now, I think if you think about it, like, there was the early migration of the Lutherans, in the 1838-9-40 period, and then probably the word would have got back, hey, you know, this place is not too bad, you know.
There were waves.
That's right. So you've got this, message that's saying, and so they decided to come out here, but we really don't, we haven't got anything written as to all what the determining factors were, but you can pretty well ascertain from history that that's what occurred, and they came out here. Now, the other thing that's interesting, the original Matthias Lucas, his occupation is listed as tailor in the manifest, I believe, I read somewhere. Now, I've sort of talked to different people about this, and they said that farming, peasant farmers weren't sort of very highly rated, but a tailor was, so he put down tailor.
Very clever.
Yeah, but when he came out here, he became a farmer and settled here at Gawler. So, that's part of that story, yeah.
So let's move on to your young years and growing up on a farm.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can talk to us about some of your, I guess, early memories of life on the farm.
Well, I can always remember my first memories are of going with them to milk the cows, and they would bale the cows up in this straw roof shed that was sort of a little bit on a lean. The straw had got too heavy for the foundations of the posts, and so it had lent a bit. I used to have a glass, and I would sit that on the rail, and if I wanted a drink, I would either give the glass to Mum, and then later on I would do it myself, but I'd go over and just fill it up and then drink the milk. All the tits were dirty and that, the milk was unpasteurised and so forth. Yep. But I can remember doing that, and I can remember.
Did your mum make cream and butter? And
oh yeah, water? Yeah. They didn't actually make very much butter, because I can remember them making butter, but not very very often. The cream truck would come around, and he'd pick up the cream, and then he'd take it to Taylor Brothers here in Gawler, and then it would be made into butter. Yep. When the butter truck, the cream truck came around, he would always have a pound of butter or whatever, you know, and they would get the butter like that. But the cream, the cream cakes, and that, goodness me. You know, the cream that you get in the supermarkets is absolute rubbish. Mum was an excellent cook. you know, in her young days, she learnt to cook for people that
yes.
had high demands, so she was a good cook. Mm. And she makes these sponge cakes. And I said that really the sponge cake was really the minor part of it. The cream was the major part. And, of course, then you didn't only have the cream. She would make jelly and she'd put lumps of jelly on it and all sorts of delicious things. And just about everything had cream in it. Another thing, funny thing I always remember is, like the chooks used to just run around the yard and so forth, and then there would always tend to be a few roosters. The desexing wasn't 100%, so there'd be some roosters mum would just keep them, and eventually she'd kill them off, and we'd eat them. Of course, they'd get aggressive at times, and he used to take after me, and I'd take off, you know, run away, and one day he took after me and I fell over, and he's on top of me, and he's scratching around, pecking me and carrying on. Mum comes around, I'm bawling my eyes out and frightened the hell out of me. I always had a fear of roosters after that. But
do you have any memories of your mum's kitchen? What was it? What it was like? What was in there? And
yeah. Well, the original kitchen in the old farmhouse was a skillion roof. It had a metres stove, I think it was, a wooden stove. It had a firebox right along over the top. Then it had the oven underneath, and on the stove always was a fountain, a cast iron fountain with a brass tap on it, and that was hot water. That was where you got your cups of tea and so forth. And the firebox on the thing wasn't very big. It was Dad's job to cut the wood, and it wouldn't be done. And so she would go out and she'd get a log, and she would set the log up, leave the door of the firebox open, let the log up, and as the log burned, she'd gradually feed it in. And she'd have it sitting on a chair. Sometimes the log would be 6 or 8 foot long. And the kitchen, it had a skillion roof, and then it had canvas nailed to the bottom of the purlins. And that was calcimined, or it was... had this type of paint stuff on it, and it sort of got heavy over the years, and so in between the purlins it was all hanging down, like it's curving down.
Yeah.
And the kitchen table, we've still got that out on the farm. Mm. It was about 8 or 9 feet long and 4 feet wide. It seat, you know, about 15 people, I reckon. Yeah. And above the kitchen table was a mallee rail, and that's where they used to hang all the metwurst and the sausage and so forth. If you was having lunch and you ran out of metwurst, you would merely stand up with a knife and cut it off another stick and fetch it down and start eating it, so you didn't even have to walk to go and get it. That was the kitchen. There was no refrigeration until about probably 1953, I think, something in that area. They bought a kerosene fridge then, and then we could have ice cream. And the ice cream, it was like a rock when it came out. It was really hard and you had to sort of break it up. But, it used to taste fabulous. It was, you know, full cream milk and they had all these different recipes. Before, the only form of preserve everything was like salting stuff, and they had a cellar, and they had one of the old Coolgardie saves the water, and they used to put the water in. I used to help put the water in sometimes. The other thing was preserved fruit too. When the the preserving system with the glass jars and that came in, they got one of those, and they used to preserve
everything.
Yeah, cases and cases of fruit.
They were very self-sustaining.
Yeah, and the fruit was magnificent too. Like, I mean, the stuff you buy is just rubbish.
Yeah.
The flavour of it and that sort of thing. But they used to get peaches from Light's Path. They had an orchard up there, which is, they used to go up and get four or five cases of $1 million an Alberta peaches. You know, they'd be
huge
in diameter, but they had a very poor shelf life. They'd get them, they would be just ready, and they'd work day and night to cut them all up and get them preserved, or otherwise they'd go just soft and rotten. Mm. But the flavour of them,
It's interesting, because just listening to you talk, you obviously have fond memories of a lot of what was happening.
Yeah, I think so. I didn't share the pessimistic attitude, I think, that was deep down in my parents' psyche because of what they'd gone through. And the other thing, too, was that that affected them a great deal was that all the time that they were married, there was no certainty of the outcome that they would eventually finish up with that little home block. The other brothers were kicking up and so forth, and it was a real uncertainty. And when Grandfather died, there was a hell of a row. When he died, and then it was all settled. And then they started, like, the early 50s were good years, and the prices were excellent. Yeah. They started to make money and things. It changed a lot. But they still didn't share the optimism of the future that I felt I shared. You know, as a young child, I saw a rosy future. You have these dreams, you know. Dad would say, you can't do that. It won't work, you know. And the other thing, I think, too, that affected them was, like, the two wars and the attitude of some people towards people of German descent was still in their thinking quite profoundly. It hadn't gone away.
It's sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you think your family had been in Australia since basically 1850 or thereabouts.
Well, they were fourth generation. I'm fifth generation. Mm. So, you know, I mean, the thing that sort of probably puts it in perspective is my father's full name was Friedrich Adolf Lucas. And, I mean, you couldn't have anything more German. And Mum always used to say to me, when Hitler got into power, and things were good, you know, back in the 1930s for a start, until they found out, he thought Hitler was good. But when he found out what was going on, no one would ever dare call him Adolf. He was called by his second name, which was quite a common thing, and he made him call him Ardy. And the Friedrich, he actually altered that to the English spelling just by, you know, when he started signing documents and so forth.
Yeah.
And then somewhere or other, government or something picked it up, and they asked him whether he was the same person, and he had to revert back to it. But that's what he did at any rate. But that it gives you an indication how they felt about that this thing, and sort of the other thing that I always remember is that I was only quite young, and Dad had to go up to Wasley's to do some paperwork on the grain that he delivered, and he got up there and the fella wasn't there, and they said, oh, he's down the pub. So I went with Dad down to the pub. We walked into the pub, and this fella sitting at the bar, straight away into Dad about his German heritage, and he had a really ding-dong go at him, and you know, you German bastards and you bloody Hitler worshippers and all this sort of stuff, you know. And anyway, Dad just says, come on, let's get out of here. And we left, we went home, we didn't get the fella.
This would have been in the 1950s?
That was in the 1950s. It was probably, maybe 52, 53, something like that, it was just after, I know Grandfather had passed away then.
So you can see how he'd be really marked by those experiences.
It leaves an indelible mark on their lives. And I don't know, I know Dad's attitude and outlook on life really changed from the optimism. After Grandfather died, there was enormous optimism. He was now free of the passed.
Yes.
And that, but then it changed in the late 60s. He became really defensive and worried about so many things that shouldn't have been. But yeah, anyway. Yeah. Mm.
So you grew up on the farm and you were... Can you talk to us a bit about school, where you went to school right. and how you got to school?
Yeah. Well, I went to the Kangaroo Flat School. That was a salubrious learning institution.
Was that a one-teacher school?
Yes, it was one-teacher school. And the teacher lived... The school house was a part of the actual school building. It was joined onto it and it was sort of... probably one or two rooms and a bit more built on and a bit more built on. And I remember the possums used to get in the roof. The schoolmaster got jack of it apparently and he poisoned them because they died up in there and they had to get Dad down there and Dad had to get these dead possums out of the roof. I remember Dad always talking about that. But yeah, probably the average number of children when I went to school, it was more when I started. It might have been 12 or 14 or 15 or something like that. But when I finished, I think it was only about 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. It was a one-teacher school. And there was a number of children coming from the Roseworthy College. And that was sort of, that actually made up the numbers. But like there were schools at Kurunny, at Reeves Plains, at Kangaroo Flat, there was...
So they were dotted around.
Oh, they were quite cool. I was one of the furthest away from the Kangaroo Flat School, and I think it was 3.25 miles. Now, the high school here used to draw its children from Malalar, and we lived on the Malalar Road. A bus used to pick up the children from Malalar right through into Gawler, and by the time they got into Gawler, they'd have a busload. But they had room on the bus still, like from our farm to Kangaroo Flat, because then they'd pick up more children further in. First of all, grandfather or someone used to take me, but then because we were over this 3 mile limit, the education department allowed the bus to pick me up, and I used to go on the bus, and that would drop me. Right at Kangaroo Flat, and then but I'd have to wait then because the bus usually was. I just used to have to wait half, three quarters of an hour before the bus would come, and the bus was pretty unreliable. It would quite frequently break down, and sometimes you'd roll up to school at 10 o'clock, and sometimes you picked up at 6:30 or something. You know, if a joke broke down on the way. The other thing I can remember is the kids have water fights on the bus. they had these water pistols and they were having water fights, and it was quite a riot. But I think we all pretty well behaved. What you hear, what goes on the buses today, you know, they damage the bus and that sort of thing. But
did you enjoy those early years at the school, or did they just get in your road?
Mum always used to say, I was dead keen to start. I couldn't wait, you know, when I was 5, 6 or whatever it was, 5 and a half. I couldn't wait. And then when I went to school, that wasn't what I expected. And things wasn't so good for a while. But then I got into it and it was all right. So I probably enjoyed going to the primary school. I was reasonably good at school, and I think I didn't create the teacher's ire too often. I didn't get cane very often, the ones that marked up and that sort of thing, but I always did my work and got it done and so forth, so I thought that stood me in good stead. But when I went to high school, it was entirely different because, hell, it was hard. And at high school, the class I went in, I think it was 49 children. And the teacher's name was Hugh Mann. And everyone say Un-Hugh Mann. That was his nickname. Yeah. The first term I didn't do too good at all. And then the second term, I know I came second in the class, and I topped school. I topped the school in some of the subjects. And that. But by the end of it, I'd had it. And I was still 13, and the school had started, and it was about a week, because it was 19th of February and the school started. Yeah. I said, I'm not going back no more, Mum. I want to go and be a farmer and stay home. And so I was still 13 years old when I left school, but I wanted to do the real thing and get out there and have a go. So that was always my plan. I didn't intend to sit around by the fire reading bedtime stories. I wanted to go out and have see what I could do with life. But
we're talking about 1956, 57 or something? Yes. When you were
56 was basically my last year at school. 57, I came home to the farm. It was a terrible drought.
Mm-hmm.
And but at any rate, we survived that. And 58 was a good year, and 59 was a terrible drought again. So we've had droughts before.
Yep.
Yeah.
They talk about hard work on the farms. I'm wondering if you can talk about possibly a typical day on the farm when you were a young boy, what time you got up and just the process. Yeah.
Well, I was never a real early riser. I used to get up, you know, in fair time, 7 o'clock or something like that. Mm. But none of this 5 o'clock was as much. Except when I had to, like when we used to take pigs away, well, you had to get up, half past four or something like that to get the pigs loaded and get them to the market before the sale started. I'd work later, and but the work was hard. It was physically very hard, but didn't have the same level of stress involved in it with what we do today. The amount of concentration and stuff when you're driving the machines, I mean, they got all of this new stuff, but it's still a worry. Yeah, everything was in bags. Your fertiliser was in bags, and your seed was in bags, and then all your grain that you sold was in bags. And the bags weren't light. They were really heavy. The fertiliser, I think, was about 180 pounds. What's that, about 80 kilos or something? It's heavy, yeah. And the worst thing about the fertiliser is you'd get the fertiliser, you'd have to get it a fair while before seeding time, and the stuff wasn't properly dried, and it would go rock hard, and then it would form these shapes, and you'd have to lump it, and it was all, you know, the big points sticking into your shoulder and all this sort of stuff. It was very difficult to handle. Smash it up with a sledgehammer, that was another thing. Yeah. Just get into it and try and break it up.
Were you lifting these bags by yourself?
Oh, yes. Like when you harvested, the box on the header held 11 bags, I think, and that was when it was brimful. You could never fill it up brimful.
Yeah.
And you would stop and you'd empty them out and quick as you can, you know, get them and shake them a bit and then put them in the heap off and then reap another box full. Then you'd have to sew them up, load them up onto the truck. We had an elevator. Dad bought an elevator when Grandfather first died. Run them up this elevator and you take them off the top. When I left school, I was still quite small. I had a lot of growing to do, and Mum always said I had appendicitis when I was 12 years old, and after I had that, I grew a lot. I was quite small. In fact, I've got pictures here. When my confirmation class, I was the smallest one in the group, but I certainly didn't finish up that way. And I became strong, and so hard work never worried me. I remember one day we used to load the bags onto the truck, and you'd put about 50 or 60 bags on the truck, and then you'd drive up to the Roseworthy, and they had an elevator there. You would load them onto the elevator, and there'd be a couple of lumpers up the top. Be cure people, you know, trucks coming in and so forth, some unloading and so forth. Or a lot of bravado and jovial batter and sort of thing, you know, and my crop will work better than yours and this sort of stuff, you know. Anyway, I'm unloading this load and this guy says to me, he says, I bet you can't put them on the elevator, the whole load, with the bags touching each other all the way up. And I says, you're on. And anyway, I'm putting them on. The fella that bet me that was up the top and his mate with him, and they couldn't keep up. They were coming up too quick, and they started to come up and they started to fall down on the stack, you see. And he yells out, "Stop, stop." So I stopped putting them on, and there were so many bags on the elevator that when it got to the top, it tipped the elevator up. And it's got these metal slats that are going around at the top, and it's grabbing all the bags that have been stacked, and it's ripping them all up. Anyway, I'm sort of standing there looking a bit, you know, and the next minute he starts to have a go at me because I stopped putting them on. And there's this old guy standing there, and he says, "You damn fool," he said, "you bet him he couldn't do it. He did it, and then you couldn't keep up." And he said, "It's your damn fault." He said, "Shut up and fix up the flippin' ripped up bags and be done with it." And, oh, you know, anyway, it was quite funny. I'll never forget that day. He bit off more than what he could handle, yeah.
Well, Malcolm, I think that's a great way to finish off our first session. And obviously we've still got a lot more stories to explore in your early farming life, so thank you very much.
Yeah, that's good. Right.